This is an ABC podcast.
Good afternoon. Welcome to The World Today. I'm Thomas Ariti. Coming up this Friday, more positive COVID cases turn up at schools in Sydney. So could Australia's most populous state be on the verge of further crackdowns? And has Victoria found patient zero, the person who inadvertently started the outbreak, which has shut the state down? We'll also hear an account of how bad the coronavirus situation is in India. The nation of 1.3 billion people is struggling. And a great day for peace or a deal steeped in cynicism and self-interest? What's behind the UAE becoming only the third Arab nation to recognise Israel? So we'll start today in Victoria, and coronavirus case numbers there are back up to 372 today. Another 14 people have died. And there's renewed speculation about where Victoria's second wave began. Samantha Donovan joins me now from Melbourne with the latest. Afternoon, Sam. So there are reports out today about the so-called patient zero, who may have been the first person to get infected in hotel quarantine. What's the latest there?
Well, Tom, the Age newspaper is reporting that what they're calling Patient Zero, Victoria's second wave, wasn't a security guard working in one of the hotel quarantine hotels, but a night duty manager who was at the Ridges Hotel on Swanson Street. That was one of the quarantine hotels. Now, the newspaper says leaked emails show that manager reported he felt unwell on May the 25th, and those emails show that the hotel then made considerable efforts to contain the spread of the infection. But it had been acknowledged, Tom, back in May by the Chief Health Officer, Brett Sutton, that a staff member at the Ridges Hotel had tested positive. So we did know that. But the term patient zero may be a bit problematic. We know the first person diagnosed was a staff member at the hotel, but were they the first person to become infected? That isn't confirmed. So perhaps this is something the independent inquiry into the hotel quarantine program will look at. The public hearings begin on Monday with evidence from epidemiologists.
Okay, and the new case numbers are up again a bit today. How much of a concern is that?
Well, there was a little bit of optimism yesterday, Tom. The numbers in terms of new cases yesterday, 278 with 8 deaths. Today we're back up to 372 new cases and, very sadly, 14 deaths. But the message from epidemiologists all week and the Premier has been, we don't just look at the tally for one day, it's all about the average over the week. And it seems most epidemiologists are very confident that the numbers are slowly coming down in Victoria. But with 372 new cases today, Tom, it's important to remember a lot of those people will become very ill, some will end up in hospital, and very sadly we know some of those people will die.
And the Federal Health Department, it's rejecting claims that Australia's COVID-19 death rate is one of the highest in the world. What's been the response there?
Yes, well, there's been a bit of pressure on the Federal Health Department this week at the Royal Commission into Aged Care. Council Assisting Peter Rosen had criticised the federal government and the Federal Health Department. He said they didn't have an adequate COVID-19 plan in place for aged care. And the Secretary of the Health Department, Professor Brendan Murphy, really hit back on that. The Council Assisting Peter Rosen has also said that about 70% of the people who died from COVID-19 in Australia were in nursing homes, and he's said that in terms of statistics worldwide, that's not a good result. The Health Department Secretary Professor Murphy has told a Senate committee hearing this morning that Australia's figures shouldn't be measured against other countries because Australia's overall death rate is low by comparison.
Every death is an absolute tragedy and it's been an awful situation, but to interpret a percentage of an extremely low death rate as an example of poor aged care management is simply not defensible.
That's Health Department Secretary Professor Brendan Murphy. Samantha Donovan, our reporter there. Let's turn to New South Wales, and a growing number of mystery cases in the state has authorities on high alert. Now, in the latest development, a third Catholic girls' high school in Sydney has had to close after a student tested positive to coronavirus. Almost every day this month, the new daily cases for New South Wales have remained in the teens, but today there were just 9 new cases. Eleni Soltis has been following the developments and she joins us now. Afternoon, Eleni. Firstly, what do we know about these new cases?
Well, a third of those cases are in hotel quarantine, so that's the good news there. But the concern is that yet another school has an infection. One new case, Tom, at St. Vincent's College at Potts Point in Sydney's inner city, closed for cleaning today. This is in addition to at least 3 students who tested positive at the Our Lady of Mercy College in Parramatta, and at least 20 cases linked to Tangara School for Girls in Sydney's northwest. And Tom, the source of the infection for that one is still unknown. And police are also investigating alleged public health breaches there. Parents have complained the school was still holding weekly choir practice, compulsory mass, and allegedly that senior students held a food stall.
Okay, now all 3 schools, Eleni, are independent schools. What has the Independent Education Union had to say about the cases?
A short time ago, Tom, I spoke to Mark Northam. He is the secretary of the New South Wales ACT branch of the Independent Education Union. And he says they're working hard to ensure no more schools are infected. And he says extracurricular activities will now be off the table.
Camps, excursions, choirs, bringing students together on buses, travelling to sport and the like. Unfortunately, during a pandemic, it's just not appropriate. And the advice that we're providing to our members in the workplace, and they are in the front line of a pandemic, is to meet as a union.
And is that advice from today?
Look, we're putting a short video clip out later on today to all our members across New South Wales and the ACT, you know, indicating they should wear a mask. And we're going further. We're entering the discussion, which is that we believe it's time that senior school students masked up as well.
What about mass? Should that be cancelled as well?
Yeah, look, at this time, most parishes, and we deal with multitudes of faith, we're a very diverse union, but look, in terms of masses specifically, obviously taking groups of students into such a setting, unless it's done inordinately carefully, is not a wise approach during a pandemic, and that's been shown in recent days in the Cherrybrook situation. And it's also been shown in a number of other settings as well, bringing students together in choirs, in woodwind, various musical settings is just no longer wise, and nor is groups of teachers visiting other schools for professional development and the like.
So do you recognise there have been breaches at these independent schools?
Look, there's some independent schools where we're bringing to the attention of the employers that we believe that some of their practices require revisiting to make sure that they're absolutely waterproof.
So breaches?
Well, I suppose they're breaches, and I don't think they're done with malice. I think that schools are frenetically busy places, and our members, their whole being is related to the welfare of those students in their care. And we're just tapping them on the shoulder and saying, I think the Premier used the term in the last couple of days that New South Wales is on a knife edge. Well, when you say that to union members who are in the front line in schools, then we need to be extraordinarily cautious as a union in the advice that we're offering, because we don't want workers and then students and the communities that those schools serve to be impacted by COVID.
Okay, so Eleni, apart from one day earlier this month, cases have been below 20 for the past fortnight. Does New South Wales have a lid on this? What are the experts saying at the moment?
Well, New South Wales has been praised by a number of leading epidemiologists for its efforts to keep the numbers low, but mystery cases are a significant cause for concern for authorities. And epidemiologist at the University of New South Wales, Professor Mary Louise McClaw, says the school infections in particular are a concerning development.
There's about 20% of total number of cases that are out there who are asymptomatic and haven't been brought to the attention of the authorities.
Should masks be made mandatory now in New South Wales?
Yes, masks should be mandatory on public transport.
Eleni Soltis reporting there, speaking to Professor Mary-Louise McClaws. Let's head abroad, and the New Zealand coronavirus outbreak is continuing to grow and has now spread beyond Auckland. 30 cases of community transmission have now been confirmed, but authorities say they believe they're all part of the same cluster. Our reporter Barbara Miller has been following the story. She's with me now. Afternoon, Barb. So cases confirmed today outside Auckland where the outbreak started. Tell us about those.
That's right, Tom. So two of what are 13 new cases today have been confirmed in the town of Tokoroa. Now, that's several hours south of Auckland. However, these are people who were visited by someone from the Auckland cluster, by two people, in fact. These are the same two people who also visited an aged care facility. All staff and residents at that facility are being tested. And in fact, no visitors are being allowed into any aged care facilities across the country. Now, authorities were asked why then they are not extending their lockdown, level three lockdown, to Waikato District, where Tokoroa is located. The Health Minister, Chris Hipkins, said that the current assessment, however, is that the risk there in that district is low.
All of the cases so far have, at this point, are connected. They are all part of one Auckland-based cluster, and that is good news. 26,000 tests have been processed in the last 48 hours since this exercise began, and we've seen no evidence of a positive COVID-19 case outside of Auckland that is unrelated to the cluster that we are dealing with. But we, of course, are not out of the woods yet.
So, Barb, are the authorities any closer to finding the source?
I think the simple answer is no. They're still looking for what's called the index case. They're still looking into this possibility of the virus somehow being present on surfaces at a cool store where a number of these positive cases work. And they're under increasing pressure over why they haven't tested more people working at the border. Now, we had the Deputy Prime Minister Winston Peters telling the ABC yesterday there had been a breach at the border. They wouldn't go into those allegations, but they did have to face repeated questioning as to why they hadn't until now, and they're expected to release an order on this later today, make compulsory testing at the border. The Health Minister, Chris Hipkins, again, said, was pressed on why people working at the border hadn't been made to take tests before now.
Look, compulsory testing is quite a big lever to pull. It is one that I think the government... It exercises a great deal of caution when making it compulsory for someone to undergo a medical procedure.
Okay, and a decision later today, Barb, on whether the current lockdown will continue.
That's right. The New Zealand Cabinet meeting this afternoon, and then they'll decide. And just a reminder, we've got the Auckland area on what's called a level three lockdown at the moment. That's pretty restrictive. People asked to stay at home, businesses closed. The rest of the country is on level two. They're just being asked to socially distance. I think we'll see some kind of continuation, certainly in Auckland, as that cluster continues to grow.
Okay, thanks, Barb. Barbara Miller reporting there. On ABC Radio across Australia, streaming online and on the ABC Listen app, this is The World Today. Thanks very much for your company. It's certainly not peace in our time, nor is it the fulfilment of the all-encompassing Trump peace plan for the Middle East that he outlined in January. But in this election year, the US leader is hailing the agreement by Israel and the United Arab Emirates to establish full diplomatic ties as a significant step forward in that goal. Some analysts, however, suggest the announcement has little to do with the Israeli-Palestinian relationship, but rather much more than regional power plays involving Iran. Barney Porter has this report.
The UAE's Foreign Affairs Minister, Anwar Gargash, says it's a great day.
This is a win-win deal. It's a win-win deal for peace in the region. And it brings actually a ray of hope in a very difficult time in our region, not known really for good times anyway.
The deal requires Israel to halt its contentious plan to annex occupied West Bank land. The minister says that means the threat to a two-state solution to end Israeli-Palestinian violence is now temporarily off the table. And President Donald Trump is confident the Palestinians will come on board.
I think the Palestinians will, without saying it necessarily yet, I think they very much want to be a part of what we're doing. And I see ultimately the Palestinians, I see peace between Israel and the Palestinians. I see that happening. I think as these very big, powerful, wealthy countries come in, I think the Palestinians will follow.
Not so, says Wazal Abul Yusuf, a member of the PLO's executive committee. Today is a sad day for the Palestinian people, he says. By announcing this agreement between the United Arab Emirates and Israel, it's a normalisation of the occupation and a stab in the back of the Palestinian people's struggle. There are even detractors on the Israeli side. Admittedly, they're settlers who are wary of any appeasement with the Arab world until the completion of their goal of the complete annexation of the West Bank, which they call Judea and Samaria. Yossi Dragan is the head of the Samaria Regional Council. If Benjamin Netanyahu sells sovereignty, he says, in exchange for a piece of paper from a country that's never threatened Israel and is far away from Israel, it's a fraud. This is not the deal of the century. This is the fraud of the century. But the elephant in the room is Iran. Jared Kushner is the president's son-in-law and senior advisor on the Middle East. He says the fact that two of the best militaries in the region have come together shows that countries today are more willing to move away from traditional positions if it suits them.
I do think that Iran has benefited from kind of dividing and conquering. Through their proxies, they've tried to create instability and they've tried to have the Middle East divided, which is why they've always taken advantage of the Palestinian issue and they've tried to stoke fear around that issue, and they've used it to keep people from joining together with Israel.
UAE now becomes the third Arab country to have full diplomatic ties with Israel after Egypt and Jordan. Martin Indyk is a distinguished fellow with the Council on Foreign Relations.
The various efforts to try to move the Israeli-Palestinian peace process forward have not succeeded, including Trump's peace plan. And none of those efforts have succeeded. But in the meantime, something else happened. And that was the rise of Iran in the region and its efforts to establish its dominance in the region, which became very threatening both to Israel and the Gulf Arab states. And as a result of that, they started to develop a sense of a common interest in combating the common threat from Iran. And that led to a lot of cooperation under the table.
Professor Uzi Rabi is the director of the Moshe Dayan Center for Middle Eastern and African Studies at Tel Aviv University. He sees short-term gains for some of the key players.
It goes without saying that President Donald Trump is going to be benefited from that. At least this is what he thinks, that he could take it as kind of a very, very profitable event for his election. Israel, well, we might say almost the same thing about Benjamin Netanyahu in kind of a similar scenario.
But he also says the move highlights a readiness by Arab countries to befriend Israel as a counterweight to Iran.
When it comes to the United Arab Emirates, well, this is a very, very vivid example of Arab states who are jumping to the conclusion that their enemy is not Israel, but Iran. Israel has become the lesser evil or the enemy of my enemy.
President Trump says he plans to host Prime Minister Netanyahu and Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan at the White House in the next 3 weeks to formalise the deal.
Barney Porter. When we look at the spread of COVID-19 around the world, the United States has, of course, been front and centre with the highest number of cases, not to mention deaths. In fact, more than 167,000 in the latest stats. But today we'll head to another country that's also been hit hard. In India, 47,000 people have now died and the number of cases is approaching 2.4 million. Let's look beyond the numbers, though, and delve into what it's like on the ground there, from the normally bustling cities to the cramped quarters of the nation's largest slum. Anirudha Gosal is the health and science reporter for Associated Press South Asia. He joined me earlier from New Delhi.
Initially, I think India was a bit late in terms of reacting to the virus. And since then, as you know, India then went into lockdown. It was a very harsh and strict lockdown of the entire country, during which the government tried really hard to bolster its healthcare system, because there are many parts of the country which are not equally served vis-a-vis healthcare. Right now, we have reached the stage where there is a bit of fatigue that is setting in. And the challenge now is to sort of ensure that this fatigue and the increased familiarity with the disease does not imply that people sort of let their guard down.
Is that what you're seeing there when you say there's fatigue? Are you starting to see sort of less of that lockdown and the social distancing?
What doctors are saying is that we often come across people who are young, who are not taking the same amount of precautions that they should be.
And looking at the strict lockdown that you said what was in place for quite a while up until now, when I think of India, and I haven't been to India, but when I think of the country, I think of huge cities like Mumbai and Delhi, where you are with bustling streets, a huge amount of activity and energy. Paint me a picture of what it's been like on the streets.
So I live in New Delhi. And there were parts of Delhi which I had no idea that those streets could look like that. Imagine a road which is full of cars all the time. And you have a situation where not only are there no cars, but there's deer roaming around on that street. I don't know who was more confused, the people who were seeing the deer from their windows or the deer thinking that where have all the people gone?
You mentioned there that the government was quite late to act initially. How would you describe the Modi government's response to the pandemic now?
Honestly, this is not a situation that anyone could foresee. But the challenge for the government has been the fact that India has such large, densely populated cities, and at the same time, the healthcare infrastructure is so unevenly distributed. The response has frankly been getting more and more sharper, I would say, in how it's being implemented. The challenge now is that if you look at the first few months of the virus, it spread through the bigger cities of the country. So you have Mumbai, you have New Delhi. Now you have a situation where the virus is now spreading into the rural parts of the country, where there just aren't enough doctors, there just aren't enough nurses, there just aren't enough hospitals in these areas. Even though the caseload is so high, it's still a very small fraction of the country which has been infected in terms of how many districts have been impacted. So this could go on for a while. So
and then of course,
that is a challenge.
There's the question of the economy as well. I imagine many people, you mentioned regional parts of India in particular, I imagine many people are part of, for lack of a better phrase, the informal economy, perhaps without any monitoring or protection from the government. What's been the impact of this virus on them?
There are people whose health has been affected, but everyone's life has been impacted because of the economic consequences. So there have been jobs lost. Say, for instance, you're a vegetable seller and you depend on going from point A to point B to get vegetables. So not only do you not have a market to sell to suddenly, you also can't get from point A to point B because there's a lockdown. So this sort of full measure of what that means is something that I fear we will only start to understand in the coming weeks.
And your expertise is, of course, in health. When it comes to the response to this virus, I've been reading that India's biggest slum, Dharavi in Mumbai, has actually been surprisingly successful in curbing the spread. Why is that? What was done there?
Dharavi is actually a very interesting case study of what can be done in a densely populated space if you are to do the things that everyone knows that you should be doing properly. What the authorities did there is that they went in early. They identified that this is a problem. They realized that the families here share toilets. Then they went around from house to house screening people, looking for people who had the slightest symptom of the virus, and then testing those people. But that is possibly a model for other similarly densely populated large areas in the country.
So given that, I mean, a success story in many ways with that case, but the number of cases in general across India is concerning. How are you feeling about the months ahead at the moment?
I'm hopeful with a sense of frustration also, because when we are talking about the fact that this virus is spreading to states where the healthcare infrastructure is not as robust, that's not something that has happened overnight. That has been the case for decades.
Anurag Asal, thanks very much for speaking to The World Today.
Thank you.
Annie Rudiger-Sales, the health and science reporter for Associated Press South Asia. He was speaking to me there from New Delhi. And that's all from the World Today team for this week. The program's producer is Mike Edwards. The associate producer is Barney Porter. Technical production by Alan Arthur and research by Fatima Alumi. We'll be back at the same time on Monday. I'm Thomas Arete. Thanks very much for your company this week. Please stay safe and have a lovely weekend. Chat soon.
Looking for Nicola Gobbo, the woman who became known as Lawyer X.
The woman at the centre of Victoria's biggest legal scandal.
Since going into hiding, the only interview she's done is with the ABC. And now we can tell her full story.
People were going to be murdered.
She was working both sides of the fence.
I will make a point of holding those who did this to account.
The Informer, a gripping new season of the hit podcast Trace. Hear it on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.